and the unusual trailer for the film, which shows no scenes, and a reconstruction of the originally planned ending, a flight from the farmhouse down the twisting roads of the Coast Highway. As for the Bird's book, I part ways with her when it comes to the subject of Hitchcock as predator. I feel that she gives the statements from Ms. Hedren of sexual harassment too much credit. I'm sure that the actress believes what she says happened, but in truth, they come across to me more as a clash of codes of behavior, Hitchcock's racy humor versus her Midwestern Puritanism. In the intro to the second edition, she writes, "Expecting great artists to live exemplary lives was a premise of a Victorian moralism discarded by the first generation of modernists." I agree, but she doesn't need to defend Hitchcock of sexual opportunism. For one thing, no other performer has ever made any such charges yet, and only one book makes the claim. Meanwhile, Patrick McGilligan, the most recent Hitchcock biographer, discounts the stories. That being said, Paulia makes a strong case for Hedren's performances for Hitchcock, and rewatching The Birds proves that Hedren truly was one of Hitchcock's best performers. Well, that's it for this week's Film 11. Until next week, be excellent to each other and party on.
And now, a blast from the past, a little tidbit from the KBOO archives.
All the world is a stage. I know that's an old cliche, but how true most of the time. My world is the stage. I'm Darcel 15, female impersonator. Entertainment, information, world affairs are my business. To continue KBOO's business, they need your support. Pledge what you can and keep the entertainment, information, and world affairs on KBOO.
This is your community radio station, KBOO Portland. Before we get going with our programming, I want to remind everyone that you can donate today at kboo.fm/give. We aren't in the station to take your calls, but you can show your support by giving online. Support KBOO now, and your donation will be matched dollar for dollar, up to $10,000 until September 20th. Thanks to the Ronnie S. LaCroute Fund of the Oregon Community Foundation. Again, that's kboo.fm/give, or you can also mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Thank you.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
In Pacific Expression.
Community and cultural coverage.
Music and calendar.
New visions and voices.
Coming to you with an Asian Pacific Islander point of view.
It's time to get on board the Apex Express.
Good evening. You're tuned in to Apex Express. We're bringing you an Asian American Pacific Islander view from the Bay and around the world. We are your hosts, Miko Lee and Jelena Keen Lee, the Power Lee Girls, a mother-daughter team. And tonight, join us for our series, We Are the Leaders, which will highlight our AAPI history of resistance and change from our ancestors to the leaders on the ground today.
We will use the dual pandemics of COVID-19 and systemic racism as a way to politically activate our community and amplify ways we can support each other. We Are the Leaders is inspired by one of our ancestor activist, Grace Lee Boggs, quote, "We are the leaders we've been looking for." So keep it locked on Apex Express.
Tonight, we're talking about movement builders, people who have shaped or led the way for API justice. We talk with Helen Zia about Vincent Chin and the start of the Asian American movement. We hear from Yuri Kochiyama about API Black Solidarity. And we talk with Julia Putnam about the legacy of Grace Lee Boggs.
Welcome to Apex Express, Helen Zia. As a journalist, scholar, activist, powerhouse woman, we are so thrilled to have you join us. right now in this time of COVID-19 and racism, I'm wondering if you can just take a moment and talk with us about the similarities of our time right now and when Vincent Chin was murdered on the streets of Detroit.
Unfortunately, it's a historical commonality when there is a time of great crisis and misery and people are suffering, that all too often they are susceptible to blaming other people and targeting them. So we've seen that at various times in history. The killing of Vincent Chin was one of those times in 1982. And I just want to say for listeners that more recently, 9/11 was certainly a time that unleashed a great deal of hatred toward anybody thought to be Muslim and the Islamophobia. But the similarity between today and the 1980s is really striking. So at that time, there was a great economic shock and crisis to the country that began as an oil crisis in 1979, and the manufacturing sector of the United States collapsed. So it began in the auto industry where I worked. I was a large press operator at a Chrysler stamping plant. And so I was one of the people laid off during that period. But pretty much the auto industry came to a halt, and every industry that was part of the supply chain, you know, whether it was tires and rubber or plastics and anything you can think of, also collapsed. So we're talking about millions of workers in pretty high paying jobs that suddenly lost everything, lost homes, lost second homes, lost two or three cars, lost recreational vehicles, lost their future, lost their children's educations, lost everything that they had worked hard all their lives for. And it looked like there was no safety net in sight. I remember standing in unemployment lines that snaked around several city blocks in the dead of a Michigan winter, and that you would be waiting there all day in the hope that you would make it to the unemployment window in time to get a very small check. And it was debated in Congress every 6 months whether to continue unemployment. The suffering index was incredibly high, and so was the feeling that somebody had to be blamed for this. And there were a lot of debates that went back and forth. You know, the auto industry first blamed the workers, saying that the workers were lazy. They were the cause of the failure of the auto industry. The workers blamed the factories. And I, too, saw just how decrepit and run down these factories were to produce defective parts that made the cars not desirable in a time that, you know, gas had gone up from 20 cents a gallon to $4 a gallon. So people couldn't even afford to drive these cars. And the people in Washington, you know, they were flinging accusations back and forth. But finally, they all agreed that the true enemy to blame was Japan. You know, the language of war, we're at war. We're talking about that now. We're at war. You know, blame China, blame, you know, and the GOP handbook actually says, you know, for this election coming up, this presidential election cycle, deflect everything and blame China. And unfortunately, that pump has been primed for quite a long time to see China as the diabolical enemy out to destroy America, the strategic enemy. And so pointing the finger at China is definitely how this is going to go. And unfortunately, the Democratic Party looks like they're going to go there too. It's going to be a real race to the depths of where racism can go. And so the kind of anger and racism that happened in the 1980s that led to the murder of Vincent Chin, we're seeing at the very beginnings today.
And now the more millions are even unemployed, and there's questions around cutting out unemployment and running out of unemployment. So it feels like it's magnified at an even greater level than during that time.
Oh, definitely. It definitely magnified at a much greater level, because every sector in American society is underwater you know, the numbers of people unemployed, and it's worldwide. So we know that this global recession that could become a global depression, economists can't even tell us when they foresee anything, you know, opening up here. And then you put on top of that, that people are getting sick and dying. We've got the economic misery and the public health crisis, which we already see is causing a lot of conflict in Washington and in the white supremacy house to elevate the economy over people's health. But either way you put it, people are suffering. And so they're very receptive. People are receptive to blaming someone else and taking out their frustration and pain on others. And those who are open to violence and racism, they're there. It's happening.
There was, during the Vincent Chin time, this galvanizing of solidarity among communities to stand up and really help to coalesce the Asian American rights movement. I'm wondering what you see from that time that we can learn from to apply to the time we're living in now.
Yes. I mean, there are lessons that we can learn from. There's no question. We cannot overcome the COVID crisis or the pandemic of racism unless we come together. And so in the 1980s, what happened was Vincent Chin was killed for looking Japanese. He was a Chinese American. And what made even that racist attack and hate crime even worse was that his killers, who were two white auto workers, got off scot-free. Basically, they got probation and fines, and the judge said, in a city of Detroit, he said, these are not the kind of men you send to jail. You fit the punishment to the criminal, not to the crime. In other words, well, these two white guys don't have to go to jail for beating somebody to death. And then what does that mean about who should be punished in a city like Detroit, which was even then, you know, about 70% African American? So there was a large uproar throughout the city. People were just appalled. You know, all people of conscience, you know, said, what do you mean? You're going to let murderers, killers off scot-free? It's almost like we get the message every day that people can't come together. People are just too divided. Well, in fact, people do come together, and we've had many historical periods where people of very different backgrounds came together. And in the Vincent Chin case, you know, it was not only Asian Americans and that came together, and remembering that time in the 1980s, Asian Americans were not together. Vincent Chin was a Chinese American. The Chinese community had to come together with the Japanese community, which was being targeted. And, you know, the Southeast Asian and Filipino and South Asian, they were all separate. So the Asian American community came together in a pan-Asian movement, and so did the allies all around us. We knew that we were too small a community to do this on our own. The various African American civil rights organizations and churches came out. So all of that, just like any organizing, really took taking time to reach out to each other, to sit down and talk. And there would be leaders in different communities who would open that door for us. It was a very, very broad-based, multiracial, multicultural, united effort to try to do something that helped launch an Asian American civil rights movement. And we need that today very much, because it's, you know, Asian Americans are being targeted and blamed, but we also see all of the disparities in health, who's black and brown people who are making up many of the essential workers who are getting sick at a much higher rate and death. There was a Chronicle article that came out the other day saying that the death rate among Asian Americans also is among the highest of all of the different racial groups. And so what's causing that? Well, it's the systemic racism that has existed. And when people say we want to get back to normal, no, we don't want to go back to normal. Actually, the virus is showing us all the fault lines that we knew were there, but it really is a matter of life and death. The idea that we can't come together really has to be banished. It's part of the poison that keeps us from coming together and was actively fomented, actually, from white supremacists, including in the White House, who realize keeping people divided is a way that they can continue and keep their power.
There have been times in our American history where we have fought back. The Third World Movement in this, you know, building of ethnic studies programs at San Francisco State, and there's been so many others where people have come together. And what do you think about, like, this time right now of different people of color coming together and helping to reshape the American story? Do you feel that's happening? Is that something you can kind of read in the tea leaves based on your experience?
I do. I believe not only can that happen, but it must happen. Everybody is under siege, and it's very clear that none of us can solve this alone. No group, whether that's political, racial, you know, sexual orientation, gender, or political party, none of us can do it alone. It really is going to take everybody working together and to kind of, you know, tune out all of the noise that are aimed to keep us divided. Looking at American society, people of color in California, for example, are already in the majority. If we could unite, we would be in the majority. And then you layer on that, that people of conscience from every color and walk of life are vastly in the majority, yet we haven't yet come together. And this crisis has to be a wake-up call for all of us. And, you know, California is one of about a dozen states that have already crossed that milestone. Within the next 10 years, the entire country is going to be majority people of color. And what does that mean? That means if we just tune out the messages that keep saying, oh, you're too divided, you know, the anti-Black views within the Asian community, anti-Asian views within the Black community, Black and brown versus yellow and white, and dividing, you know, having that narrative divide us continually is just serving that purpose to keep us divided. If we came together in what we have in common, we really are the majority, and we could really make some change. And we have to make change because people are getting sick and dying within our communities. That's the vision we have to hold on to. I do think we'll get there. We have done it before, many, many times in our history. So those are the lessons we need to draw from and seek out the unity that we really do have.
Some of the key figures in really holding up that unity and helping us to realize the social justice movement have been women, and particularly mothers, from Emmett Till's mom to the founders of Black Lives Matter. There's been so many women and moms that have really helped be leaders. And I'm wondering about your experience of working with Vincent Chin's mom, because without her, we would have also not be so aware of his case.
If it hadn't been for Lily Chin, Vincent's mother, she was the inspirational leadership for all of us to follow. Her willingness to keep fighting and bearing her pain over and over again, to say no other mother, no other family should have to suffer this. Her quest for justice was what really kept this movement going. And it is women. You know, we've already noticed, I think some of the world has noticed, that it's the countries that have had women leaders at the helm that have done the best with fighting this virus. Leaders aren't having the big egos that say it's all about me. We can look to the women leaders. I think that would take us very far.
What do you want young activists to know about our API activist history?
I would love for the API younger activists today to know that we have such a rich history of activism that goes back to our first days on this continent. They should be proud of that, and to know that they're carrying on a very rich and strong legacy forward. When Martin Luther King and the other civil rights activists were crossing the Pettus Bridge, that famous march through Selma, Alabama, they were all wearing lays. I was very sad to see that the movie that just got made about that showed them without the lays. Where did the lays come from? They came from activists in Hawaii who were supporting that march, and many people, many Asian people were also there.
My dad was there.
He was.
Yes. My dad was a reverend, Dr. Robert Lee, and he marched. He was one of the, that was my feeling about seeing that movie too. I loved it. I love Ava's work, but I was saying, where are our people? That they were part of the story. My dad was part of the story.
Absolutely.
So,
yes, absolutely. And wow, that's so wonderful to know that your dad was part of that. And so what we see is, even today, with such a wonderful movie to commemorate and embed that moment in all of our psyches, is missing a historical piece. Because any photograph of that time, you see the involvement of Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders that were there. So we get erased. I want young activists today to know that, yes, we have been marginalized, erased. I call it MIH, that we are so often missing in history. The only thing that's going to change that is our voices. We have to restore that history. We were there, and it's just that other people don't know that. We've done a lot to affect the lives of every American. That was true for the Vincent Chin case. That was true after 9/11. That, you know, the Me Too movement, women who have survived sexual harassment or sexual assault standing up at a trial, facing their accuser and saying, this is what that harm did to me. Part of that victim impact statement, momentum for that also came from the Vincent Chin. The fact that we can be born in America and be citizens, that's because of a Chinese American back in the 1800s who took that all the way to the Supreme Court. Brown versus Board of Education, the legal justification for that came from a Chinese American laundry who objected to be taxed as separate. So that was a Supreme Court case too, that then was the underpinnings for Brown versus Board of Education. The great, great boycott that was initiated by Filipino American farm workers and then involved Cesar Chavez and the Chicano farm workers. That was initiated by Asian Americans. We have so many things that we can be proud of, but are MIH, missing in history. The only people who are going to have to point that out is us, because we've been systematically removed from this history. And that's part of the racism that we have to fight too. Asian American activists can be proud of the things that our forebears have done for us and for the whole country.
You've been a pathmaker, a pioneer in so many ways, from being the labor worker in Detroit and editor of Ms. Magazine and undercover in sweatshops in Chinatown and a pioneer in marriage equality. So much of your life is kind of embedded in this wanting to tell the missing in history, the story that hasn't been told. How do you want our next generation to take that on?
None of us is just one-dimensional. We're not just our race or our sexual orientation or our gender or our ability or any of that. It's that we are human. So we have many dimensions and we're complex beings. So to whatever energy and extent every one of us has to raise our voices and raise our hands, no matter what the issue is, if we can do that and speak from our hearts about our own authentic experiences by raising your hand and speaking and standing up, no matter which arena, you know, of social justice and equality and all of that, no matter what it is, then we make a difference. We show up in all of our complexity. Wherever we do that, it really makes a difference. And that's where organizing comes in too, so that we're not the only ones. You know, the task is to get other people to speak up too. And then we have a movement and the potential for great change.
Thank you for your wisdom, as always. We really appreciate you.
Well, thank you for having me, Miko, and thank you for all the great work that you're doing.
Thank you.
Such important conversations.
Next up, listen to Blues Scholar's Ode to Yuri Kochiyama.
Even if them kids cop the shirts and start wearing them, humbled in the presence of the veterans and not the ones who picked up their guns, but who picked up their brethren and sisterin. History in the making, I was witnessing, listening. Seen this old Japanese lady with a sticker on her walker said, "Free Mumia." And this was before the Trustafarians were saying it, taking it for granted as we talk about the 60s and never get to talk to anybody who done lived the still exists, or better yet, she still resists, speaking to a myriad of young, dumb, and ignorant kids. I was one of them, stuck around lingering, said that it's a privilege to meet you in person, and she took my hand, said it's good to meet you too, and when I'm out of school, asked me what I'm gonna do. I had to think about it, but truth is I knew that it was something for the youth and shit. Truly, I'd probably be a teacher if the music didn't make enough to make me want to gamble on its sustenance, and that's why I'm writing this to tell y'all, from a scholar. When I grow up, I wanna be just like Yuri Kochiyama. Holla, swear to my kasamas. When I grow up, I wanna be just like Yuri Kochiyama. And if she ever hear this, it's an honor. Cause when I grow up, I wanna be just like Yuri Kochiyama. Tama, serve the people proper. And when I grow up, I wanna be just like Yuri Kochiyama. I seen a picture up in Life magazine. You were sitting front seat for Malcolm's last speech. Saw the first man with the shotgun. Two more came to get the job done. Now who would have thought that it'd be you holding him? I wonder what you felt when his eyes were going dim. And if he never died, would we know that he exists? Or would he been the leader that...
That was Blue Scholar's Ode to Yuri Kochiyama. When we first envisioned this series, one of the first ancestor activists that came to mind was Yuri. I was raised with an understanding of the legacy of solidarity that she represented and saw her speak at community events, and I'm still inspired by her lifetime of activism. Yuri Kochiyama was born in the Bay Area and as a 21-year-old was incarcerated at Camp Jerome in Arkansas, one of the concentration camps that held 120,000 Japanese and Japanese-American citizens during World War II. She has talked about how that illegal act helped shape her political identity.
And then after World War II, Yuri moved with her husband Bill to New York, where they raised their 6 kids in a low-income housing project in Harlem. She spent time at the Harlem Freedom School, a grassroots organization advocating for safer streets and school integration, and learning about Black history from Black speakers, artists, and activists. It was through the Harlem Freedom School that Yuri first met Malcolm X. Let's listen to Yuri describe Malcolm X coming to her house.
He came here to meet with some of the writers of the Hiroshima-Nagasaki World Peace Study Mission because they wanted to meet Malcolm more than any other person in the United States. I think they were curious to know why the U.S. government would be so afraid of just one Black leader.
Next up, listen to Yuri at Asian American Heritage Month at Laney College in 2002. She speaks about the hidden history of interactions between Asians and Africans and Asian Americans and Black Americans.
That's the year that the U.S. government launched a Chinese Exclusion Act. This act or law ruled that Chinese would not be allowed to come into this country again. And yet this act went into effect just after the Chinese had spent years building the railroad tracks from the Pacific coast to the Midwest. There was only one lone voice that opposed this order, the Chinese Exclusion Act. And this courageous person was a Black man, the first Black man who became senator in Mississippi, Senator Blanche K. Bruce. Bruce felt an Foreign Exclusion Act was an outright show of racism. There were no other exclusion acts before. Unless this was meant, he felt there would surely be more groups of people who would be excluded and sent away from here. I think his sensitivity to the Chinese was because he was himself black and had experienced many such situations. He fought against the bill by himself, and of course the bill passed, and for years and years Chinese were not allowed to come in. But we as Asians, we must never forget those who tried to assist us in our journey, as this lone black senator did. You will not find everything in school texts. We must dig them and find them ourselves. In 1899, Theodore Roosevelt's U.S. Army invaded the Philippines and committed one of the most horrendous massacres in history. Nearly a million Filipinos were killed. The black soldiers who were part of the U.S. Army were so shocked by the brutality and atrocity of the Americans, and because they were feeling more of a kinship with the brown-skinned Filipinos, the black soldiers left the American army and went into the hills and joined the Filipino guerrillas. One of the blacks, David Fagan, organized a black contingent of guerrillas and fought side by side with the Filipinos. Of course, you would not find this kind of story in American history books either.
Yuri worked on so many different issues in addition to rights for the African American community. One of the things she's probably most well known for is this iconic image of her in Life magazine cradling Malcolm X as he was assassinated. And I remember seeing that when I was young, thinking, who is that Asian woman in the image? And I always wonder why her story wasn't told. And so finding out more about her and all the work that she has done has been really powerful.
Yeah, and she's been involved in so many different stances and so many different political actions all throughout her extremely long life, which I think is just so impressive. And it's such a testament to really committing to activism as a lifelong practice and not, and, you know, making it sustainable in some ways too, in order to be able to do it for so long. She's been involved in anti-imperialism and anti-Vietnam War protests, labor organizing, supporting the development of ethnic studies, prison abolition, and is a longtime pen pal of Mumia Abul-Jamal, and even co-founded Asians for Mumia, a collective of Asian and Asian Americans fighting for Abul-Jamal's release.
And she was also one of the people advocating for reparations for Japanese Americans that were incarcerated, such as herself and her whole family. She fought against racial profiling of Arabs and Muslims and South Asians after 9/11. So she was really doing intersectional work before that term was even something that was used so commonly. She has been a powerful member of our community, and we really honor her. And the legacy she's left behind is not just so many activists we know, but her own children, like Adi Kochiyama, who is out there still working at Asian Americans Advancing Justice. And we're so proud of the contributions that she has made. So next up, we're going to listen to her great challenge to the API community.
Asian Americans must be more vocal, visible, and take stands on crucial issues. Hopefully, Asians will side with the most dispossessed, oppressed, and marginalized, remembering our own history. We Asians need to reshape our image from the rather quiet, ambiguous, accommodating, uncomplaining, palatable people to a more resolute, sensitive advocate for human worth, human rights, and human dignity.
Wise words from the great Yuri Kochiyama. Next up, listen to Blue Scholars' No Rest for the Weary.
vibe, a little wine, talk head, get the concrete to line with your spine. I seek to find peace, but it's war all the time. It's deep like the drive from Renton to Shoreline. I'm a more mindful guy ever since finding out that I'm about to be your father. And doubt is not an option, and now I can't be getting crunk to faded as often. So get your hands dirty, cause a prayer ain't enough, boss. What cross? We got crucified by buckshot. 1 million Jesuses and Judas got his nuts off. Pages torn out the memory of those who remain shackled in the chains of international capital gain. They claim civilized with the animal ways. Peace to Oakland, I've never been a fan of the A. But some days you can find me inscribing my soul on the page. Every crime has an alibi. Disciplined and organized is how I handle mine. New Jacks is spending mad time on they battle rhymes. I can't knock it if you find it entertaining. I rep those whose labor ain't compensated. So check the work ethic and the name. The lessons might change, but the essence of the message is the same. So when they say anything, say why is it? Class is in session till the teacher gets a big slip. 40 to a class, no wonder we delinquent. Half the school district never make it to commencement. I bend the spine of the track until it snap. Pop's working overtime and he got a broken back. Got three little sisters, one brother in Iraq. And mom prays novenas to keep the fam intact. But this song ain't a song waiting for God to answer. Brothers call me dog, they got the letters backwards. I'm back with a plan of attack to repossess my name, face, and history, y'all. Who wants test my capacity to spit caliber shit into a rhythmic lesson? And edutainment's a legitimate weapon. Igniting the cipher sessions, I'm deciphering life. And blending both theory into practice, I write vernacular and actual fact. God, no posturing. 1,000 points and fingers, I defied every one of them. I ride for my brethren who carry the burden of a future uncertain till the fall of the curtain. You better move. Hold your head high, soldier, it ain't over yet. That's why we call it a struggle.
Welcome back. You're tuned in to Apex Express on 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley and online at kpfa.org. That was Blue Scholars, No Rest for the Weary.
Welcome, Julia Putnam, to Apex Express. We are so thrilled that you're joining us. You are the co-founder of the James and Grace Lee Boggs School in Detroit. Can you just first talk with us about how you very first met Grace Lee Boggs?
I first met Grace Lee Boggs when I was 16 years old. I had shown up to the opening ceremony for Detroit Summer in 1992. Detroit Summer was a youth program meant to rebuild, re-spirit, and redefine Detroit from the ground up. And Grace co-founded that organization with her late husband.
I understand that she sat behind you on your first day and asked you a question. What was the question?
I remember her asking, what is it that I thought young people could do to rebuild Detroit? And I remember thinking that was a huge question. I did not know the answer to it. I hadn't really thought about it, but she asked it in a way that made me understand she really thought I could contribute to that discussion, and that she took me seriously enough to believe that I could add to that. And it made me think I need to take myself seriously enough and I need to be thinking about these things.
So I understand that she was sort of famous for asking probing questions.
Yes.
And sometimes those might have been hard, right?
They were almost always hard questions. If you came to visit her and would talk with her without doing what she thought was your proper homework, she would be very dismissive and just like, why am I spending my time with someone who isn't thoughtful? So you never wanted to be in that situation with Grace.
I understand that Grace and Jimmy's house was sort of like an activist boot camp, that there are always people around that were working on issues. Can you describe a little bit about what their household was like?
People who have long time been in the movement say that there's no activist in Detroit who has not visited Jimmy and Grace's home. And it's a warm place. It's got a living room where there are just couches and chairs and books. And when you would walk in, you would be greeted by Jimmy and Grace and just greeted by great conversation. They would often have things for you to read, articles you should take away, videos you should watch. There's so many more people who could speak to that than me, who came to the house later in their years, and they had been doing so much work for decades before I came to the fold.
So you were 16, though, when you first started working and signed up for Detroit Summer, right?
Well, Detroit Summer was geared towards young people. So it was very specifically for 14 years old into college age. There would be young people, high schoolers and college students working with longtime activists. We would have intergenerational dialogues weekly where the young people would come up with a question and interview an elder and then have a conversation amongst all of us about a particular topic. And it was really impactful for me as a high school student to see college students engaging in this work and taking it further beyond high school. It just helped me understand that there was not only a history of activism in Detroit, but that I could see myself as doing this for the long term.
Why do you think intergenerational dialogue was so critical to Grace?
I think it's because Grace understood the importance of dialectics, that elders could come up with solutions to problems, but that it wouldn't be the end of those problems. They would bring up new contradictions and new things to think about and new problems to solve. And it was important for young people to be engaged. And in order for the work to continue, the young people would have to continue that work, and they had to do it while being rooted in history and rooted in what came before, the wisdom of that and the lessons of that. And also, young people energize older people and vice versa. I just think that she thought that there was so much that generations could learn from one another.
What is one of your strongest memories of Grace?
I was 19 or so. I was her intern for a summer. My role, as I saw it, was helping Grace to organize her study. She would have these cardboard folders that would contain articles that she had read over the years or newspapers, and she would label topics and put these articles and newspapers in those folders. And a lot of the newspapers were yellowing, a lot of the papers were kind of just jammed in there. And I would say, Grace, you've written an article on this already, or the newspaper that exists here digitally, we should get rid of these or we can throw these away. And she was very resistant to that. And it was really frustrating because I thought, well, what am I supposed to be doing here? And I came to her one time really troubled, and I said to her, it feels like we're arguing a lot. And she grinned at me and she said, I know, it's great, isn't it? We're struggling. And she said it with such joy. And it helped me understand that for her, arguing, conflict, struggling was not a negative thing. She was saying, as we're learning from one another, we are frustrating one another, which is moving us toward forward. And it helped me to not be so afraid to be in conflict with people that I cared about, to be in conflict with people that I trusted. I can have an opinion that is different from hers, and she sees that as okay because it means that we're struggling through something. That was really helpful and continues to help me in my work today.
I love that story. Can you also talk about how she signed her letters, how she did her sign off?
She would sign off in love and struggle, Grace, that love doesn't come without struggle, and that when we communicate with one another, we are communicating out of love, and we are also communicating out of the struggle we have with one another.
She's really saying the struggle's messy and it's hard, but it's part of it. It's all part of it.
It's all part of it.
Yeah. What do you feel is the legacy that she leaves behind? And obviously with her husband, Jimmy, too.
When we asked her permission to name the school after her, the James and Grace Lee Boggs School, she said yes, but with the challenge that we would have to, as the school founders, think beyond what we even believe is possible. I am one of the co-founders, along with Amanda Rossman and Marisol Teachworth. And the three of us together as three women of different ethnicities, very much love and struggle together, and also take it very seriously, this idea that we've been indoctrinated as to what school is, and when things get hard, we will default to what we know as opposed to continue to imagine something different. And so we often challenge ourselves with that and challenge our staff, and we all challenge one another to, are we thinking beyond what we believe is possible? What is beyond the binary that we're being stuck in right now? So that's the legacy that Grace leaves to us that is very important. And the other thing is that, again, that idea of her taking young people seriously, and she saw young people as solutionaries, people who are able to problem solve, to see a challenge and come up with solutions for it. She saw young people as especially creative in their ability to do that. And so on the school t-shirts that kids get, there's the Bog School logo, but on the back it says solutionary. And the kids really take on that identity. They take it very seriously. They take it very personally. Often when they come up with a solution to a problem, they'll just kind of put their fingers up and just, I'm a solutionary. I figured it out. And having that identity as young people has been really important to our school, for all of us.
I love that. I was really excited to visit your school a couple of years ago and meet you. And I was struck by, one, of course, the engaged students, and also the beautiful artwork that was all around. And I think there's a mural in there that has that Grace quote, "We must believe we have the power within us to create the world anew," which really kind of speaks to what you're talking about, that leaving behind this idea of thinking about the world in a different place. Can you share one example about how your school embodies that, how you transform the traditional kind of systemic public education system and use it in a different way?
We're still thinking about how to do that and still challenging ourselves beyond what's traditional. But one way we do that is that we use a place-based model of education and learning, and we belong to a network of schools that do that. And so every year there is a community forum that organization, the coalition, puts together, SIMMES, the Southeastern Michigan Stewardship Coalition. And the community forum is a time in which the community comes together to be the audience for children's learning. And so the kids are presenting and the kids are teaching us.
That's great. I love that. Going really back to when you first met her, I mean, there's not that many Asian American folks in Detroit, right?
Remember there being a Chung's restaurant, and Chung's was kind of the outlier, the last remaining Chinese restaurant in what was Chinatown in Detroit. And I learned that there was huge Hmong population in Detroit, and that Asian Americans actually did have an existence. It's just that Detroit's so segregated, and the conversation is often so centered around Black and white that there hadn't been room for this conversation about Asian Americans, and there hadn't been visibility from my perspective as an African American growing up. So that was another gift that Detroit Summer gave me. But also, it is true that Grace surrounded herself in the Black Power movement and in the Black struggle, and so she was often seen as an outlier. But she isn't alone in Detroit. And I think that it's her work in Detroit Summer and people finding her, young Asian American activists finding her and using her story as a way to develop their own identity and their own voice in activism in Detroit, really allowed her to connect with her Asian American identity. And I just want to give a shout out, because the mural that you mentioned in the school was made by Katie Yamasaki, who is Japanese American and has written children's stories about the internment, and also just joyful stories about her cousins and growing up with them. And so even to have that presence in the school and have the kids know that Katie is the granddaughter of a famous architect in Detroit, Japanese architect in Detroit, is another way in which we are making beyond Black and white visible in our school.
I'm wondering if there are thoughts that you feel Grace would be teaching right now in this time.
I think Grace would be highlighting that fact of the young people in the movement, their leadership in this movement. I think she would be encouraging us to listen to young people. I think she would be listening to young people. And I think that she would say, I actually think she'd be very excited by this time, heartbroken in the ways that we all are, but also excited that we are being forced in this moment to realize that things need to be reimagined. We are being forced to use our imaginations for how we stay connected in this time, how we educate in this time, how we organize in this time, how we govern ourselves and how we think about governance in a completely different way than we've ever had to before. This is the moment where not only do we have to reimagine, but we also have to realize that we're the leaders that we're looking for. She would often say when we were thinking about the school is that we don't have a lot of leadership around education, and certainly not around the education we know that our communities need. She would say, Julia, Amanda, Monty, you all have to imagine this differently yourselves. You are the leaders that you've been looking for. No one's coming to figure this out for you. And so we feel as the founders that we, with our community of parents and students and community members, are beginning to think about how to do this differently and to look to the leadership of young people.
Can you share about the school and how it got started and sort of what you feel are the greatest successes and then the ongoing challenges?
James and Grace Lee Boggs School is a K through 8 school on the east side of Detroit. We began planning this as an offshoot of conversations that we've been having, we educators have been having, in Grace and Jimmy's home for many, many years. And in 2008, decided to formally plan a school that was based in the values that we had been discussing. The school opened in 2013 as a K through 4 school, and we've grown to include K through 8. And I think the successes of the school is that it very much feels community-based. I think young people feel as if their voices are valued. I think families feel as if they truly are partners with us. We care for one another in very deliberate ways. Even when we struggle, we don't always have the resources that we need to do all of the things that we want, but we are able to do a lot with a little, including making sure the kids have arts and gym and music, African drumming and dance. And the kids see themselves very much as our mission, which is to nurture creative, critical thinkers who contribute to the well-being of their communities. I think ongoing challenges are continuing to feel restricted by the continuing belief in standardization in this country and us not being able to imagine young people as being in charge of their education and their learning, and the fact that school funding is not equitable or responsive to the very diverse needs of students and families. And that we also live in a system in which schools are relied on to provide social services that should be intact in other places, such as healthcare and food. And so those are the ongoing challenges of education that I'm excited that are becoming more of a national conversation than they have been before. I would also just say how glad I am to be in solidarity with so many people from all ethnicities right now, and how good it feels for people to be discovering that we all have a common struggle together, and that is equal rights and justice for all. And I'm proud to be part of Grace and Jimmy's legacy, and I'm proud to be at this moment in time struggling through what it means to be a free country.
In love and struggle, right?
Amen. Yes.
Next up, listen to George Jackson by the Blue Scholars.
Bring justice to the judges like a Soledad brother. Picture me falling, Leonardo's last supper. Now it's overcast, under just another night slumbering. The lights flash, suddenly the clouds now under me. And if you know me, then you know that I ain't wanna be caught up in mythology, except my name probably. Never read the Odyssey, put it in a song for me. Stimuli economy, highway robbery. I'm seeing stars though, cosmology. You seeing assholes, proctology. So what's your policy if not to be the best that you could possibly be without trying to be me? And now you trying to change the world when your home is a mess. Got your priorities mixed, huh? You failing a test. It's like passing on a diamond for a dame in a dress. You prematurely champagneing on your way to success, I guess. Everybody got a road to the next. And some of us believe, and it's bold to suggest, that it was all written in a God-bound text. Like we got no power to change the whole script. Me, I think you are more in charge than you think. They want you behind bars and not the ones that you spit. You still rapping a rap, I'm so over the shit. We calling this a rap, here's a present in fact, I said. Nobody move, everybody get hurt. I'm sticking up the world now for everything it's worth. Cause I ain't trying to rest if this shit is getting worse. And I'm trying to do more than just put it in a verse. Nobody move, everybody get hurt. I'm sticking up the world now for everything it's worth. I ain't trying to rest, shit is getting worse. Gotta do more than just put it in a verse.
That was George Jackson by the Blue Scholars. Thank you so much for joining us on our show today to talk with Helen Zia, to hear from visionary activist Yuri Kochiyama, and to talk with Julia Putnam about Grace Lee Boggs.
And we know that Julia runs the school that's named after Grace Lee Boggs, so that's part of her legacy. But Grace was such a brilliant scholar, an amazing writer. She's written all these books. And one of the things that really struck me lately is that she talks about how growing up as a Chinese American girl, she learned really quickly the world needed changing. And she said, the time has come for us to reimagine everything. We have to reimagine work and go away from labor. We have to reimagine revolution and get beyond protest. We have to think not only about change in our institutions, but changes in ourselves. We are at the stage where the people in charge of the government and industry are running around like chickens with their heads cut off. It's up to us to reimagine the alternatives and not just protest against them and expect them to do better. We have to do what I call visionary organizing. We have to see every crisis as both a danger and an opportunity. It's a danger because it does so much damage to our lives, to our institutions, to all that we've expected, but it's also an opportunity for us to become creative, to become the new kind of people that are needed at such a huge period of transition. So those were words that she wrote in 2002, but they're still totally relevant today.
Even more relevant today. And gosh, imagine if we were having this kind of visionary period in 2002. We could be living in a whole other world now. And I think it just goes to show that there is no time left to wait. The revisioning our world is urgent. It is prescient. The dangers are upon us. And now it's the time to really hone in on our roots and all of our ancestral lineage of Asian American activism in order to inform the kind of world that we want to create and that we want to live in.
Yeah, that's right. And all three of our guests also spoke about API people and our stories being missing in history.
So M-I-H.
M-I-H, as Helen says, I'm going to remember that one. So why do you think that's been so?
I think our stories are missing from history as a part of systemic white supremacy, and it's used to bolster up this model minority myth that Asians are quiet, submissive.
Part of the divide and conquer mode.
Exactly, and completely erasing our history of being on the front lines, walking in Selma, being part of the leaders of the farm workers movement, you know, being involved in pretty much every social issue, even up until this day, whether it comes to, you know, kids being in cages, immigration issues, ICE, DACA, you know, all these different issues. We are still doing this work today, working with incarcerated folks, as we heard from last week, working with restaurant workers. You know, this is a really powerful and important lineage. And I think cutting people off from their history, it can make you feel lost and make you not understand the pride that
that is part of your right as being a minority in this country and being part of such a powerful minority group. And I think Helen spoke to that as well.
It's very empowering and important for us to recognize and honor our ancestor activists and live up to Grace Lee Boggs and Yuri Kochiyama and Vincent Chin and Helen Zia and all the guests that we've talked to, live up to their heroic activism and get in there and do the work ourselves.
Yes. They are the reason that we have ethnic studies, so it is our responsibility to do that studying.
Because as Grace Lee Boggs said,
we are the leaders we've been looking for.
Over the next 3 months, every other week, we'll continue with our series, We Are the Leaders. We'll feature ancestors and current social justice activists such as Helen Zia, Adi Kochiyama, and Saru Jayaraman. Join us to carry on the legacy of our activist ancestors because, like Grace Lee Boggs says, we are the leaders we've been looking for.
Please check out our website, kpfa.org, to find out more about We Are the Leaders and the guests we spoke to and how you can take direct action. We thank the San Francisco Foundation for helping us to set up home studios and supporting the We Are the Leaders series. We thank all of you listeners out there. Keep resisting, keep organizing, keep creating and sharing your visions with the world. Your voices are important. Apex Express is produced by Preeti Mangalashekar, Tracy Nguyen, Miko Lee, Jelena Keenly, and Jessica Antonio. Tonight's show was produced by your hosts, Miko Lee and Jelena Keenly.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM and streaming on the web, kboo.fm. I'm Don Jacobson, and moving on, we'll be here in just a few minutes right after the news.